Hello and welcome to The Motivation Mindset. I'm Risa Williams. I'm a therapist in Los Angeles and the book author of The Ultimate Time Management Toolkit and The Procrastination Playbook, as well as other books. And this is a podcast about getting things done without all the stress. And if you'd like to work with me on getting things done, join my Get Stuff Done Goals group. We meet every month on Zoom. You can sign up at patreon.com/Risa Williams. And our next meeting is April 19th. At 9 a.m. So I hope to see you there. And now for another episode on getting things done without all the stress. So after Sivan was on the show last time, we were having a funny conversation. And I don't remember which one of us said it, but we were saying how there are a million ways that people get themselves stuck. And there's only like a few ways people get themselves unstuck. Right, do you remember that?
Yeah. It was probably you that said it. We'll blame you for that conversation.
Okay. But I mean, there's a truth to that, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, I think most of my job is really trying to help people get past their thinking. It's people get stuck in like a loop of negative thinking or thoughts that aren't kind of based in reality or have evidence to support that they're true. And they operate as though that's their reality. And I'm like, why do you continue to engage in this maze of chaos? It's right. Not helpful to you.
And sometimes we don't even realize what thoughts are getting us stuck. We just feel stuck. We just feel overwhelmed, or we start avoiding things, or we start feeling paralyzed in our decision-making, you know, like what am I supposed to do next? And these are some examples of getting stuck, right? Like procrastination, decision paralysis. What are some other examples of getting stuck? Like, how would you know you're stuck on the outside?
So like what I see is I see people kind of focus on the problem and not solutions. And so they just kind of go down this rabbit hole of negativity and kind of ruminate over what's going wrong, what could go wrong. And so they're like you said, that paralysis of behavior. They just kind of don't do anything. Or it's the thing that I'm seeing a lot more now with my clients is like this idea that I know what decision to make, but if I make this decision, it's going to have bad outcomes or unpleasant outcomes for somebody else. And so they don't want to do anything. And it's like, well, that's also not helpful.
Right. So it's using our imaginations to constantly imagine disasters and catastrophes for everything that we are uncertain of, right?
Yes. People are excellent at making stuff up.
Yeah.
So I like to call them out on that in ways that like, hey, this doesn't make sense to me. How is it that it's making sense to you?
Why don't we use our imaginations in ways to picture positive outcomes, do you think?
Oh man, I think that goes back to kind of like the evolutionary psychology thing.
Yeah.
If you don't plan for the worst, then that's like death in our early human life. So we've learned a way of like telling ourselves that if we focus on the unpleasant things or the things that could potentially cause us danger or the worst case scenario, that's how we survive and live.
Right.
Maybe that was helpful, like when you're, you know, out on the plains where we were like, yeah.
But it doesn't like, work in modern day life so well, right?
Yeah, not so much when you're like at the juice bar in Whole Foods. Like, I don't know that you need to be so worried.
Or in
about,
line about... at like the grocery store or taking your kid to school, maybe, and you're just picturing every possible bad scenario ever.
Yeah. Right. It's like, I don't think that we need to be so overly concerned with all that stuff. I think you'll be all right. And the thing I kind of like to say is like, well, how often did the worst case scenario ever come true? And like the percentages are like next to nil. So for people, it's the thing of where I try to get them to understand the difference between like possibility and probability. And so like something is possible, people treat it as though it's likely to happen or more likely to happen. And I'm like, well, that's not necessarily the case. Like a plane could fall on my house. That's possible. Anything's possible. I also don't think it's highly probable. Like planes aren't always falling on houses. So like, I don't know that I need to be so concerned about that.
Right. And once we open the door to those kinds of scenarios, I mean, where do you stop? You could just go on forever with disasters you're imagining. That happens like 1% chance of happening.
But it's so easy for people to kind of like get focused on that stuff and like to never remove themselves. Like they really can't see past the idea that this hasn't happened and it has like a low likelihood of happening. And so, you know, it's, oh, if I make this mistake in this email, I'm probably going to get fired. Like, yeah, probably not. People aren't perfect. Mistakes happen. I think you'll be okay. But like they don't see it that way.
Yeah, because it feels so real to them. And there's just like a fear, like you said, we're tapping into some kind of primitive fear that gets sparked. And that fear makes us feel like, oh, it's really going to happen. Like, I'm going to send this email and the person is going to be so mad that they're going to fire me instantaneously or something like this.
Right. It's. I mean, think about it, like for what we do, too. Like when we were interns and like working towards our licenses, like, you know, the thing is, oh, I don't want to lose my license. I'm so fearful of like, if I don't have my notes written correctly, I'm going to get my license revoked and I'll be never going to do therapy again.
Right.
And the reality is like when you look in the disciplinary actions, like in the back of the therapist magazine, none of it's for notes. Like it's not, none of the people getting in trouble had like bad notes. Like that's not what people are getting in trouble at all. Yeah.
It's like a red mark on your file, writes terrible notes.
Right. Remove license, never allowed to do therapy again. Like that's never happened. It's for more egregious things. And I think that, you know, human beings are really good at, I guess, like adopting and not recognizing that they've adopted this idea of perfectionism, that if I am imperfect, then I am opening myself up to, you know, disaster.
Right. And I think with perfectionism, we also have the unstated belief that if I am perfect, everyone will love me and everything will be great and I will reach eternal happiness, right? Like I need to be perfect in order to be loved and for people to even recognize anything I'm doing. But if I'm imperfect, automatically the worst things are going to happen. So if you look at it through that lens, it's a scary lens. Like to put that pressure on yourself for every task that you have to do.
Right. Unnecessarily so, right? Like it's none of what you just said is true either way. Like,
no, both are distorted. And there's a huge middle ground in the middle. All right. So I want to go back to a post I read that you put on your Instagram. It said imposter syndrome will have you remaining in spaces you've outgrown and probably had no business inhabiting in the first place. I thought that was so deep. I thought that was so true. Can you explain that a little more?
Absolutely. Thank you. I always like when somebody says, oh, I'm going to talk to you about your post. I'm like, oh, no, which one was it?
Well, you post a lot about imposter syndrome and a lot about calling out your inner bully, right? 100%. And not letting yourself run rampant with these perfectionistic thoughts, you know?
Yeah. And so for me, like when I wrote that post, I was just thinking about how people let their imposterism kind of get them to stay in places or stay at levels because they fear that if they level up, they won't have what it takes. Or that, you know, if they really try or put themselves out there, they're going to get seen for not having the skill set that they've already exhibited that they do, you know, do have or are in possession of. And so it makes you stay in places or in rooms or at levels that you probably don't belong at.
Right.
And probably had no business being there anyway, because if you just kind of leaned into yourself, or what I like to say, kind of radically accept yourself, then you would have leveled up and kind of been doing all sorts of great things that would have elevated you to a place that you actually did belong. And so I think that people, you know, kind of it's, I don't want to say like self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's kind of self-sabotage, right? Like they put these arbitrary limits on their ability to thrive and evolve and grow out of fear of not being able to maintain or sustain it.
What you're saying is so true. I think a lot of the reasons people get stuck, I mean, if you want to simplify it down, go back to fear and self-doubt. You know, it's sort of like one of those two things, even if you're looking at something like, why am I procrastinating or why am I not pushing myself forward another step? It almost always goes back to those two and sometimes a combo of both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, fear is it can be a motivator or it can be kind of a deterrent. Right. And so oftentimes I think the folks I work with or the people like we encounter that get stuck, it's a fear of either failure or a fear of actually being successful. Both of those can be problematic.
Right.
If I fail, I'm going to be so embarrassed and I'm going to disappoint everyone and it's going to be something I can't endure and it's going to be terrible and horrible. Just all these negative words that they choose to describe it, these adjectives. Or if I'm successful, there's this fear that, oh, I won't be able to sustain it. I won't be able to continue at this level, or people are going to see that, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, or I don't have it all together. And it's all based out of no evidence. Like they haven't done anything in the future. Like they haven't done the thing. We haven't gotten there yet.
Right.
They've told and convinced themselves of this like fatal outcome either way. Like it's going to be bad or terrible if I do a great job or if I do a horrible job.
Right. So it's a no-win situation. And it's what I call an imaginary disaster movie. Like you've already written the script of the disaster movie. And in this disaster movie, even success leads to a disaster, which I think is so messed up. You're setting up this no way out, right? Like, I'm either going to fail miserably and everyone will notice it'll be the worst ever, or I'm going to succeed and somehow success will also be a failure. Right. It's almost like we create that distorted equation, which makes you feel paralyzed. Like, what's the point of moving forward? Now our brain is like, what's my motivation to take the next step? what am I going right, towards? Right.
like, who wants to run towards what's disaster? The prize? Like, no. Terrible outcomes. Go get yours now. Like, nobody wants to do that.
There's no treat at the end. And I know my brain needs a treat of some kind or a reward, like absolutely. At the end. And if you're saying, here's the success reward, but by the way, in parentheses, it's also a disaster. Now my brain is like, I'm just going to stay in bed. Why should I do that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like nobody wants a reward that's going to suck. So if you convince your brain that like everything you do, no matter if it's fantastic and amazing or if it's the worst possible, you know, performance you could ever have, the outcome is going to be, hey, you're going to get a dud. Like it's going to suck for you at the end of both of these things. Then I should just stay where I am. Like I should not do anything.
Right. So in a sneaky way, I think perfectionism is procrastination. Like it's a way to procrastinate and stall. But on the outside, we're saying, well, I'm getting ready. It's sneaky in that way, right? Because it keeps you trapped, but it has the appearance of something it isn't, if that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's what people aren't aware of. That's why I try to make sure that folks are understanding the messages that they're sending to their brain. So, you know, it's the thing we say, but then it's also the message we're getting. And so, you know, oh, I'm getting ready is the message. And then the meta message our brain is getting is like, don't do anything. Like, do not do anything.
Do not pass go. It leads to disaster.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
I call it like, you know, the old computers when you had the spinning wheel and it would get jammed up. It's like you've issued too many commands that conflict. And your brain is the spinning wheel of death. It's like, what's the point? I can't. Do you want me to go? Do you want me to stop? I don't know what to do now. You know?
Yep. Yep. And your brain is like now in this loop of nowhere. It's a loop that leads to nowhere it wants to be.
Nowhere so like, good.
Oh, I've got 100%. And so I have to be protective. And so your brain is going to do what it needs to do to make sure you stay safe because you convinced it that if you move forward or if you make a decision, whatever it is, it will be unsafe.
Right. So how do we get ourselves picturing a better outcome or at least getting our brain on board to move forward, getting out of that loop, the spinning wheel loop?
It's the rigid thinking, right? Like we've only imagined two possible outcomes. And like you said, those are like at the far end of the spectrum of possibility, like possible outcomes we could have. So the idea is to like, find ways to introduce like what else could also happen. Because sure, you could fail miserably and it'd be terrible, or you could succeed and people hate it. Also, you could succeed and people love it. And you could also fail and people not be so, you know, kind of destroyed or lead to disaster for you. Like there are all these other things. Or you could do like a pretty solid job and nothing happens. Like there's all sorts
it's of neutral
things like outcomes we could get.
Yeah, often I work with people to see that there is a neutral option and they're usually okay with that. Like, what if it's just okay? And, you know, maybe a few people like it, maybe a few people don't. Maybe you learn, maybe you figure out what you want to do next. Most of the time when we walk through that scenario, people are like, oh, well, that's okay with me too. Like a neutral option seems fine, you know?
Yeah. And then the other thing I like to do is kind of get people to think about what happened before. Because I'm sure this isn't the first time you've come to a crossroads where I've got to make this decision. And if I make it, it's going to be the worst ever. Like, well, what happened the last time you made a decision? Oh, well, nothing bad happened. Let's just go with that. Like, let's just say that. Like,
you actually have data that shows you it was okay. last time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, exactly. Like just roll with that part that, hey, you know what? Last time I had to make a decision and none of the crazy, like outlandish things that I came up with happened. So maybe like that'll happen again. Like introduce that as a possibility.
So it's like find past proof, past data, and then show it to your brain's computer and say, look at the data. It doesn't really match this disaster movie so well.
That's my favorite phrase is to ask people, where's the evidence? Show me the evidence. Show me the evidence that what you determined is going to happen is very, very likely to happen. Like, I want to be able to put my money on this and say, hey, you know what? You're right. We predicted the future. Let's go be rich now. Like, we know exactly how this is going to turn out. And they're like, yeah, well, I don't know. Then I can't bet. You just made something up.
Yeah.
And I'm not just going to go off of what you made up because you're just saying things at that point.
Yeah. Their argument becomes flimsier and flimsier the more you're asking for actual evidence. I think in your book, The Acknowledgement Journal, in my book, The Ultimate Self-Esteem Toolkit, we came to the same visual analogy, which is a courtroom setting. You have thoughts on trial, and I have the evidence investigator. And it's the same idea of, I think people are always trying to be a negativity lawyer towards themselves, where it's like there's a lawyer inside your brain always trying to prove to you that something's going to be a disaster or that you're a bad person. And you need a counter defense attorney who's arguing your case, like, hey, wait a minute. That's way off base here. And sort of your tool thoughts on trial is very similar. It's take that faulty thought and then, you know, show me evidence, right?
It's exactly what you said. It's countering, you know, that lawyer that wants to tell us everything's going to end in disaster and having someone present like, well, there's some good things that could happen from this. And here's some past evidence of good things that have happened to you. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot about all those. And so it's like, you know, forcing you to weigh both sides of the issue, just like in a courtroom, like they get to present both sides of like, hey, this person's guilty, this person's not guilty. And then let's examine the evidence. Right. So like, is there more evidence to support that? Yeah, that you're probably going to screw everything up and your life is going to be a disaster and miserable and you should just like not do anything ever again. Or is it like there more evidence to suggest like, yeah, stuff could go wrong, but I also like it's more likely that you'll be fine, the world will be okay, and you'll go on and do great things in life and continue to be fantastic.
So if someone is feeling stuck, what are some questions they could ask themselves in that moment? I know when I work with people, sometimes just identifying that you are stuck is the first step, right? So for instance, like if I'm putting off doing something, if I find I'm in a cycle where I'm like avoiding opening an email and I haven't responded to it, it's been 2 weeks. The first thing I admit to myself is, hey, I seem to be avoiding an email. I have noticed I'm not answering that email. What's going on with me? It's like that simple step of not just brushing it under the rug and continuing in the same cycle, but like, what am I doing? And why am I doing it? And why am I feeling stuck? What would you suggest?
That is absolutely the line of questioning that I adopt as well. I say it in a way that says, you're aware that you aren't doing something. What is the thought you're having about it? So like, what is the narrative? I try to get people to talk about the story they're telling themselves about why they haven't done the thing. So if you do the thing, what are you telling yourself is going to happen? Because whatever you're telling yourself is what's preventing you from being able to move forward.
Exactly.
And so once I have them tease that out and become aware of the thoughts they're having and the narrative or story they've developed based on that, then we can start to kind of chip away at, okay, so is that true? Is this thing, this story you've adopted and you're believing and you're operating and behaving based on, is it true that that's going to happen? Is there evidence to support it? And that's when, you know, things start to go awry for them. They're like, well, not so much. Oh, then you're just making stuff up. How about we create a different story that's more appropriate for what you're getting in the world?
Right. So walk through with me. Let's do a little role play. I'm avoiding an email. I don't want to answer it for some reason. It's changing like an appointment or something. But for whatever reason, it's been sitting in my inbox for like a week and I'm not looking at it.
And I would say, okay, so you're not looking at the email. What do you tell yourself will happen if you open it and respond to it?
Well, let's say I say something like, well, it's just, it's not a fun thing. And I don't want to reschedule this appointment. And I know we're going to go back and forth a lot. Maybe I'm avoiding some kind of future conflict or feeling uncomfortable, you know, with navigating our schedules.
Sure. And I understand that. And that, like, so every time you try to schedule an appointment, there's always this back and forth. And it's annoying to have to deal with. So you avoid, and then at some point you decide to have to make the appointment. So like what I tell people, and this is probably what they don't like from me, is I would say to you, well, then let's just not schedule it until you have to. Like something will happen at some point that you're going to have to schedule the appointment. So if it's, you know, to get like a checkup or something, like, hey, maybe you're not sick right now and you're okay. Well, at some point, maybe you'll develop symptoms and then you'll have to schedule an appointment. So it's just like, you know, wait until that happens.
Right. So you kind of just play out their philosophy, which they're not maybe admitting to themselves. Like, I don't want to do it. I think where people get stuck sometimes is I don't want to do it. It's not fun. Like my brain has labeled this not fun or stressful in some way. I just don't even want to look at it. But when you're having them, you're walking them, you're saying, okay, do that. And then, you know, then you'll have to do this. You're kind of calling them out on their plan, which they don't even want to look at.
Right, right. It's people, and I try to teach people about this. It's the idea of low frustration tolerance.
Yeah.
People do not like unpleasantness. And they've got this idea or belief that unpleasantness is unbearable. It's horrible. It's terrible. And I just shouldn't have to deal with it. And I don't know that like good things don't come with some element of unpleasantness.
Well, and it's sort of just the life we're living, like on this planet, it's full of uncomfortable things.
Yeah.
And maybe it's about embracing that things are always going to feel a little uncomfortable. Yep. So how do we get comfortable more with being uncomfortable?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most things that are good also have an element of discomfort. I mean,
right.
I like having a home and a roof over my head. There's a bill attached to that.
Exactly.
I don't like that bill, but also I pay
and it. All the maintenance. You have to maintain it all the time. Do. It doesn't just stop because you get the house. It just keeps going.
Cheap. It's not cheap. Like it is a black hole where money goes to die. Like,
and it's a time set. I mean, you're committing some time to this thing now that you own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also would rather have a roof than not. Like that's
the other option is not great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I do is kind of just like process through with people of like, well, let's just wait till things get worse and terrible. And then you won't be allowed to procrastinate anymore.
Right.
You'll have to make a decision. And then what people usually do is say, well, I don't want things to get that bad. Then, oh, maybe we should go ahead.
Maybe
and
we should just take.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take the little uncomfortable before it becomes a big uncomfortable, because big uncomfortable is so much worse than little uncomfortable.
Right. You can do that now on under your own control and own volition, or you can wait till the universe says, hey, you can't ignore this anymore. I'm okay with either way. Like I am fine with whatever you decide. You get to control it or it gets controlled for you. You tell me which one you want to do.
So then when you give your brain those choices, your brain is like, oh, I'll pick this one.
Right. Oh, yes. Exactly.
Now that you've made it clear to me what the choices are.
Yeah.
So here's a fun thing. Okay, so we're talking about very serious, like kind of, you know, high stress situations. But even with little things, I do a game sometimes with my brain where if I'm avoiding a task, I just tell it can do one of two things. And both those things are things I need to do. And then I just see where my brain goes. And this is a way of playing this game with yourself in a lighter way with like everyday tasks. So an example would be like, I have to do the laundry or write a chapter of my book. Like that's the choices I give my brain. Like right now you have a free time. We're not going to watch Netflix right now or whatever. We're going to like write the chapter of your book or do some light cleaning. So my brain will be like, oh, I'm going to do some cleaning. That sounds great because I don't want to do the chapter right now. But it's a win because now I've said, hey, at least we're moving some area forward, right?
Yeah, you're still productive. It's an intervention I used to use when I did family therapy. So like when, you know, people are talking about their kids and as an example, like say the kid doesn't want to eat vegetables, you don't ask the kid, like, do you want vegetables or not? You say, hey, do you want broccoli or spinach?
Exactly. You know, narrow the choice.
The message is you're going to have to eat vegetables where you have some power and some autonomy and agency. is to decide which vegetable you're going to eat. That is what you get to choose.
Yeah. We don't say, do you want broccoli or ice cream? That's right. A bad choice. Broccoli or carrots, pick one, go.
100%. That's exactly it. And so that, I love that you do that with your brain now. It's, you know, I've got these two things. You got to do one of them.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to do?
Yeah. And sometimes it picks the low hanging fruit, but then you move that forward a little bit too. So thank you so much, Steve Vaughn, for all this insight. I think it's so great. If you would have one piece of advice to leave people with about getting stuck, what would it be?
My one piece of advice for people who are getting stuck would be to question your thinking. So always is as you're behaving and you're investigating, hey, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? What's the thought I'm having? Is to really question and say, well, I need you to provide me with some evidence that this is really true. Look for evidence, look for evidence, look for evidence.
I love that. So look for evidence, question your brain, question what you're doing, simply asking yourself, what am I doing right now? what am I thinking? What are the thoughts behind what I'm doing? Is a great way to just be mindful and make choices that lead you to better emotional outcomes. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's so much fun talking to you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If you're enjoying tools discussed on the show, please visit risawilliams.com. There you can learn more about my wonderful guests, upcoming episodes, my books and planners, and classes and workshops. You can also follow me on Instagram at risawilliamstherapy for free giveaways and discounts. I'm Risa Williams, and we're out of time. Thanks for listening.